Midday Report on 702, your number one news and talk station.
It's exactly 6 minutes past 12 o'clock. Good afternoon from me, Ray White, with you on the Midday Report. Welcome to Monday. Well, talking cricket shortly, outrage after Australian cricketers admit to hatching a plot to tamper with the ball. I must admit, at the weekend, I was quite gobsmacked. You think to yourself, it's Australia, it's the Proteas, you don't do this type of thing. Well, they did. So, talking to former Proteas fast bowler Mackay Antini shortly about this, and also our correspondent in Sydney, Australia, Rob Calder. Then also coming up, a few land grabs at the weekend. People are desperate for housing. Looking at who's actually driving this, though, and possible solutions, but is this becoming a political football? Then good news as well at the weekend. Moody's improves the country's outlook to stable, but will the other ratings agencies now follow? And then later on, chatting to UB40 frontman Ali Campbell. They're coming to this country. Looking really forward to that interview. I'd like to hear from you on the program this afternoon. SMS me 31702 or 31567 or tweet on @ray1. Essay.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
Well, let's get to the big story that everybody is talking about. It was a weekend of absolute astonishment at the crickets in Newlands with the Australian ball tampering saga. The captain of the Aussie team, Steve Smith, was suspended by the ICC for one test and then fined 100% of his match fee following his damning admission that the ball was tampered with during the test match against the Proteas. The admission came after young opener Cameron Bancroft was caught on camera meddling with the ball. Meddling. Smith has four demerits now handed down by the ICC. Smith and his deputy David Warner have also stepped down from their roles, and Cricket Australia CEO James Sutherland will be travelling to our country to join its integrity committee probing the incident. On the line is former Proteas fast bowler Mackay Antini. Good afternoon, Mackay. Welcome to the Midday Report.
Morning, Mr. Whitey. How are you doing? I thought you were going to say there's a white in Australia, and then now we have white in South Africa.
Yeah, we do. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. Now, getting down to the basics, this is totally unexpected of Australia. I mean, in all your experience, did you ever think you'd ever see this?
Listen, you know, when we're sitting around the table, we're just watching the game with the friends of mine, and then we're saying, how did that happen? Because both of these teams are big teams. There's no such thing that you should be trying to be bigger than the other one by tempering the ball. That thing is out of law. That's no good.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. Now, the
badly man is wrong.
Yeah, I never thought I'd see this. But kind of the punishment meted out seems to be light. Has the ICC maybe missed a chance to stamp its authority on this and say this is not acceptable?
If you remember the late Ansi Cronier, where we were playing in Sharjah against India, you know, there was a similar situation where he stood on the ball with his stats.
Yeah.
And then it was a big saga, you know. And then you come back to South Africa, Rabada brushing the shoulder of the same person, Smith. Mm. And then he gets banned for 2 games. And then Smith temper with the ball. You got only 1 game ban. What is that?
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
That's absolutely wrong.
Yeah. Do you think this is going to be taken further, though? I mean, after all of this is said and done, maybe Cricket Australia will say, okay, ICC, you've taken your action, but we're going to take something a little bit stronger.
But I think, you know, as a South African, they've done a very good thing, not trying to, you know, follow up on that one and let the ICC do it. We are strong enough. We are strong believers that the game of cricket, you know, when we're meeting the best, we want to show who's the best. We're not going to be trying to beat the country by using, you know, some different methods. We've got the ball, they've got the bat, you know, they must just face it. You know, for South Africans, I really, really clap hands for them for not really, really taking into that big war. All they can do is say, the ICC, that's your duty. Take control of it and see what is going to happen. You know, and we are waiting for you. You know, output out of that, and then we take decision from there. If, you know, South Africa wants to take it on to the further, you know, stage of all things.
Mm. It just seems also quite bizarre that Cameron Bancroft did this with the cameras on him. I mean, didn't he realize that they follow the ball wherever it goes?
No, I think, you know, from the Australian side point of view, because he's a youngster, they will never, the camera never thought that they should follow him. They're always looking at David Warner because he's a big mouth boy, and look at Smith and whoever, that the senior player will do that. So when he was caught, you could see that he's nervous. He didn't know what to do, you know, with the sandpaper that he was using to temper the ball. He didn't know to throw it on the floor, to put it in his pocket, to put it in his pants. You know, it was one of those, I would say he was nervous forever that anyone else would have been.
Yeah, and also maybe putting it down your pants was not a very good idea.
It was not a good idea at all.
You know, we are watching this. What what do you think should happen next in this whole saga?
I think ICC should absolutely, you know, take a very, very good, you know, decision within that. Because you must understand, whatever happened after this one, whatever country that get caught up, you know, doing exactly the same thing, they can never punish that person more than what they have done to the Australian guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
They need to be very, very careful or whatever that they do. If that is, that it's punishable.
Yeah.
They need to make sure that they punish the person accordingly. Not just because an Australian, yes, he admitted. That one, you know, that's another thing, that what you're going to do, because the guy says, yes, I did it. But yeah, it would never happen again. What will you do in that situation?
You see, you're
apologizing. You can't punish every the person that is admitting that yes, I did.
Yeah.
You know, I'm waiting for whatever situation or whatever decision you're gonna take. I am guilty of what has happened, but it will never happen again. What are you gonna do?
Now, you see, to say sorry, maybe it's not enough. You're actually quite right. Maybe it has to come with this lengthy ban that says, this has happened now, it'll never happen again. Because if it does, you just don't play cricket again.
Yeah, that's how it's going to be.
Absolutely.
You know, if they ban Hansi Kronje, you see, with ball tempering, because that match fixing what they've done.
Yeah, it's exactly, you know, the
and
same
then,
as
it's exactly that. You look at Herschel Gibbs, he couldn't go to India. You know, Nicky Boyer couldn't go to India because of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then now it's an Australian. What are you going to do? Because that's absolutely match fixing.
Yeah, let's hope somebody sticks up their hand and says, this is not acceptable, and the sentence that is meted out is a little bit more than this. Former Proteas fast bowler Mackay Antini, it's been a pleasure having you on the Madeira Report.
No problem, Mr. Whitey.
Speak to you soon.
Absolutely. See you soon, Mr. Whitey.
That's Mackay Antini. I love chatting to him. Mackay Antini on the Madeira Report. Let's stay with the story now, and it's a very serious story. Let's get to Rob Calder in Sydney, Australia, just to find out what Australians are saying in Sydney. Good afternoon or good evening to you, Rob.
Hi, Ray. How are you doing? And I feel like I'm following quite a personality.
You are, and it brings the mood down a little bit, because what has the response been in Australia?
Look, as I've never known such a morose mood in the country. Literally, people are talking about it. There's a level of embarrassment. I think there's a level of shame. Because you've got to understand, the cricket team is the only team that represents the whole of the country. We've got the football codes, but they tend to be divided by state. And they often talk about the Australian cricket captain as being the second most important role in the country after the Prime Minister. So the fact that the captain, our best player, you know, the best player of many generations has done this, is really, people are shattered. They can't believe it. It's actually, you know, I cannot believe, why would he do this? Why would they do this as a team?
Rob, where does this come from? I mean, I'm thinking of Australian cricket greats that, you know, you think Australian, you think, wow, these guys are fantastic. Steve Waugh, even Shane Warne, he was there at the cricket speaking out about this. Where does this come from?
Ray, Australia is no longer sort of the easygoing larrikin country that it was made out to be sort of in the 70s. But I don't think you can rule out the past as influencing the current days. Steve Waugh had his, you know, mental disintegration policy, which, you know, was basically, you know, ripping into the opposition. So he had no problems in using non-cricket tactics to win a game. So if you view that as a legacy, this is just taking things to its extreme, win at all costs. What pushed them over the line to actually break the rules of cricket and cheat is something no one will ever get, because I'm sure it will come out in detail in the next few days. But it's a shocking, because it's nearly like a conspiracy of the, you know, senior members of the team using a young player to carry out their dirty illegal work. It's like, it's as bad as that, and it's cheating. It's not, you know, it's Steve Smith saying, sorry, they made a mistake. A mistake is a bad tactic, or, you know, doing something which meant you lose the game. It is cheating. This is breaking the law. And it's risked a whole lot of things. From a cricket point of view, it's massive, because while this is going on, the Australian Cricket Board are actually negotiating their media rights. Mm. So this has got the potential to cost the Australian cricket business millions of dollars. It's putting off sponsors. You know, two of the main sponsors of Australian cricket are one of the largest banks and Qantas. And they're rethinking what they're going to do, because it's tainted the sport in a big way.
Sure, that's quite something. I mean, the Prime Minister coming out yesterday, he was scathing in what he had to say.
Well, I mean, rightly so. People have come from all walks of life, and people that aren't into cricket have been shocked by it, because I think it's symbolising something bigger in the country. I think it does, you know, symbolise that this, you know, win-it-all-cost kind of attitude and lack of ethics and morals is coming across in all elements of life, and cricket's just sort of a symptom of what's going on. I mean, at the same time as, you know, this going on, we have an inquiry into the banking industry in Australia, and there's been instance after instance of the banks behaving inappropriately and immoral. So it's happening in the business world, it's happening in the sporting world, and, you know, the effect on society and the youth and all that kind of stuff, to see that what their role model's doing is not great for the soul of the country.
Yeah, it's quite something. Interesting that you say that. Maybe the national psyche needs to change a little bit, and leaders need to put their hands up and say, this is not what we do as Australians.
Absolutely. And I've read articles where people, and I think it's a bit rich, but sort of comparing it to the Me Too issue, because I don't think it's quite like that, but it does definitely touch on, you know, what is it to be an Australian, and what are Australian values, and the conversation about Australian values is not being brought up often. It's always about pragmatism. And I mean, Ray, we spoke last week about you know, the issue of Australia and white farmers potentially being fast-tracked, and that's a pragmatic thing. You know, let's try and find some immigrants which are, and I'm putting inverted commas, but good for the country. And the underlying undertone of that is, well, we want someone that can contribute, as opposed to, you know, more foreign, I'm also doing inverted commas, kind of immigrants. So there's a lot of soul searching that needs to happen in this country, and this is really opened a wound, which in maybe a positive will be that the conversation will begin and people will actually start thinking about morals and ethics. And, you know, I could talk about specifics of cricket, but in my opinion, it's a bit bigger than cricket.
Yeah, it seems that way. A hostile reception, I suppose, on their return. The players will not be looking forward to coming home.
No, I don't think so. I mean, Steve Smith is already out of the next test. I think that it's pretty likely that David Warner will be taken out of the next test. The head of Australian cricket is arriving. There's been no mention. Darren Lehman, the coach, who, you know, many people are blaming because, to be honest, he's responsible for the culture of the team.
Yeah. You know,
what is the team culture? What was going on? What made people even contemplate this? And you know what? The thing is, this is why people can't really believe it. What's the worst that would have happened if if, you know, they didn't do it. They lose a test match to a really good team.
Yeah.
And then they've got another chance of the next test. Like, the stakes are high, I suppose, from their perspective, but reality is it's a game and you win some and you lose some. And it's a high, it's wrecked the best test cricket series in years. It's absolutely wrecked what was a phenomenal series. And that's a big shame. Australia's probably going to have to fly players out now because I don't know how many of the team will be, you know, selected in the fourth test. It's, you know, I mean, there's been calls for us to forfeit the next test, which I think, I don't think they could from a legal perspective.
It really damages the sport, our Australian correspondent. Rob Calder, thanks for your time on the line from Sydney, Australia.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
21 minutes past 12 o'clock, the DA has called on President Cyril Ramaphosa to do anything in his power to prevent illegal land invasions in the country. This follows the arrest of five people who are attempting to occupy vacant land in Waterfall in Midrand at the weekend. In another incident, police blocked a group of Alexandra residents from invading land in Marlborough. The party has accused the EFF of encouraging these land invasions. The big question is, what happens to land, and people do need it? On the line is the Gauteng Human Settlements MEC, Uhuru Mulwa. Good afternoon, MEC. Welcome to the Midday Report.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Raymond. How are you?
Great. Great to have you on the Midday Report. Frustration that people need housing. What are your thoughts on what happened at the weekend?
Totally not an acceptable situation. Everybody who is a South African knows that the constitution of this country provides for the homeless to be catered for by the state, okay? But within the available means, meaning we've got to budget, you know, to house people that are homeless. So there's actually no doubt about the commitment of government to provide housing for the poor, to secure land with services for the poor, and this is what we are doing. The Premier of the province has pronounced in the State of the Province address about the provincial government's human settlement program of developing mega cities, Savannah City, you know, John Dube in the East Rand, Savannah City in the South, Vaal River City, Lanseria City. We are developing cities.
Yeah.
These plans are in a process, and this seeks to depopulate places like Alexander, Deep Slot, and areas such as those. And this has got nothing to do with black-white thing. It has got to do with a province that is rapidly urbanizing. The population is growing very much. So we've got to think about how are we going to address the human settlement need going forward.
MEC, sorry to cut you, has this been communicated to the people? Because it appears that this could be used as a quite volatile political football. When you talk land, you can promise people anything and you'll get votes.
Unfortunately, this is what some political parties are doing, and I think this is a dangerous game, quite honestly speaking, because you are moving people into a land that doesn't have services, doesn't have toilets, doesn't have water. What are you actually doing? You are using the vulnerable to push your own political agenda. And this includes also local government, in this case, the city of Johannesburg, city of Tshwane, and all these municipalities not acting swiftly when the bylaws of the municipality are being violated. And in part, it is because we're in a quite a precarious situation. You have a political arrangement at municipal level where, you know, parties are holding each other to ransom, right?
Mm-hmm.
My people are going to occupy the land. You remove them, you have lost your mayorship, right?
Mm.
And so this is like a carrot and a stick kind of a situation. Now, I think we should stop pointing at each other fingers. We must deal with an urban space that is rapidly urbanizing, and we need cool heads as to how to deal with this situation. But illegal land occupation is definitely a no-no, because it's a seat for disaster in the nearest future.
MEC,
we must not encourage this.
Are you going to be talking, though, to those communities? Are you going to be going down this week to say to them, there is a plan, hold on?
This is the partnership that my department is embarking on. I am consulting with internally with my administration, and I'm putting together a plan that will take me to communities just to outline where Gauteng is going and where we think Gauteng should be in the next 100 years. Because people must not think about themselves now. They must say, will my child's child be happy in the next 100 years when they look back and say, yes, there was Uhuru Muyiwa, who was MEC of Human Settlement. There was Mashatile there at some point. Have they created the kind of country that I can be proud of, you know?
Yeah.
Or have got to demolish what they have started? Now, this is the future vision that I want to share with the people of Gauteng. The political parties have to come to the party, you know? Mm. This is not time for cheap populism.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
I'm not interested in that game.
Yeah.
We need to talk truth to ourselves and say, this is best for our country. And clearly, the issue of the land acquisition is a process that has started in Parliament. I think we've got to give that process an opportunity so that the nation can debate about the desperations of people that have got hunger for land, but in an orderly fashion. We are living in a country that is governed by the rule of law. We cannot allow lawlessness and anarchy to take
absolutely.
Root. Definitely there, we will not tolerate it.
Gauteng Human Settlements MEC, Uhuru Muyiwa, I really do appreciate your time this afternoon and joining us on the Midday Report.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
Also, some of your tweets on Atre White SA. Zuko says, laugh out loud, you gotta love Mackay and Tini. Let the ICC perform their duties and then respond according after due process. Karen Key says, Atre White SA, not the first time with board tampering by Bancroft. And she sent an article. I've now retweeted that on Atre White SA. Thank you, Karen. Then on the SMS line, one says, stop building shopping centres, build houses for goodness sake. And that is from Jay. And then another one says, hi Ray, we have an exploding population and already there is not enough land for all and everybody wants to live in the cities. That one is from Nicholas. Keep your SMSs coming, 31702 or 31567. In your business news, Germany's
Midday Report. Business.
Well, there we go. That makes it official. Germany's Aton intends to make a buyout of construction group Marion Roberts as a cash offer price of 15 Rand per share. The SA company has confirmed that Aton, a private investment holding company in Germany, increased its shareholding in Marion Roberts to 29.9% between February and April last year. This makes it the largest shareholder. Shares in Marion Roberts have since surged by more than 48%. In other news now, Uber is selling its Southeast Asia rideshare and food delivery businesses to rival Grab. The move marks a further retreat from international operations for Uber after it sold its China business to a local rival. Both firms describe the deal as a win for their passengers, but analysts warn it could mean higher prices. Think about it. Competition's going. Grab is Southeast Asia's most popular ride-sharing firm with millions of users across 8 countries. Under the terms of the deal, Uber will take a 27.5% stake in Singapore-based Grab. Uber's chief executive then gets a place on the board. Looking at the markets, a short while ago, the All Share was down about 0.5% at 56,092 points. Looking at the Rand, that's the big success story of the day. The Rand has been trading around a one-month high against the dollar as investors cheered ratings agency Moody's decision to affirm the country's investment-grade credit rating and revise its outlook to stable from negative. That was the story that broke at about midnight on Friday night. The Rand is now 11.62 to the dollar, 16.51 to the pound, 14.42 to the euro. Gold, $1,348.88. Platinum, $946.74. And then Brent crude oil creeping up, $70.36. More business news with Bruce this afternoon and, of course, on The Money Show.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
Well, let's stay with Moody's now, and there's been a collective sigh of relief after ratings agency Moody's raised the country's outlook to stable, keeping the overall rating unchanged, though. It believes the previous weakening of South Africa's institutions will gradually reverse under a more transparent and predictable policy framework. But the big question is, are we out of the woods just yet? The other agencies have us all in junk status. On the line is the director and chief economist at Econometrics, Pediatrics, Dr. Azar Jamin. Good afternoon, Doctor. Welcome to the Midday Report.
Good afternoon to you and to your listeners.
A positive move on Friday, but will the other agencies follow? That's the big question.
Well, by the other agencies following, I suppose you are meaning will they upgrade our credit rating from junk status to investment grade?
That's because right.
Currently, yeah, because currently Moody's is the only one that has us still on investment grade. And the answer to that is no, I don't think so. And I derive that from just listening to a presentation made by the head of Standard & Poor's Global a month ago, in which he basically said that S&P downgraded us to junk status because they got sick and tired of the fact that we kept pushing out the date at which we intended to embark upon fiscal discipline and reduce our budget deficits and our public debt to GDP ratio. We kept pushing it out further and further. We kept promising fiscal discipline, and yet the ratio of public debt to GDP just kept rising. And they said, well, enough is enough. Now, what is required to reverse that trend? It requires a good few years of sharply reduced budget deficits. And certainly that does not appear to be on the cards, even in relation to the latest February budget that was presented, because all that showed was the budget deficit remaining at 3.5% of GDP, and with an economy set to grow at somewhere between 1.5% and 2%, per annum, and you've got a deficit of 3.5% of GDP, that means your borrowings have to carry on increasing as a proportion of the economy. And that is not what the ratings agencies are looking for to return us to investment grade.
Yeah. Structural reform, as you've highlighted, it is maybe one way of getting around this. And I was looking at an article from the Treasury and basically saying that privatization of our SOEs may be the answer to this.
I'm extremely encouraged. I didn't see that the Treasury had actually spoken about privatization, because I thought it was anathema for anyone in government to use the P word, as it's called. Yes, that would be one way of overcoming. That would be one structural reform. But there are many. There are, you know, will we see our success in fighting corruption and state capture? Will we see government diverting funding away from funding a bigger and more bloated and expensive public service towards infrastructural investment? Certainly from the latest budget, it seems the opposite. Will we see government improving the outcomes of the educational system? Will we see government succeeding in breaking down the concentration of power in the hands of few organizations, both public and private? Many of these issues, and the one encouraging thing is we are seeing government and private sector starting to work more closely together, and that is a good start. But there's a long, long way to go to generate the kind of reforms that are needed to lift our growth rate to in excess of the budget deficit, in other words, more than 3.5% of GDP, because only that way will we start reducing the need to keep borrowing at the rate in excess of the size of the size of the economy.
Yeah. And then there's land expropriation without compensation. How does this factor into everything? Because if investors do see this, they may be a little bit scared.
Yeah, no question. And Moody's did actually mention that. It mentioned land expropriation without compensation. It mentioned potential possible failure to reach a new mining charter. It also complained about the possibility that the government wouldn't be able to damp down wage increases in the public sector. All these are challenges that will need to be faced and that do stand in the way of us improving our credit ratings. Land expropriation without compensation, there's still a tremendous amount of uncertainty. But with that hanging over us, unfortunately, it works against the one factor that could have really boosted economic growth in the next year or so, given the improvement in confidence since Ramaphosa was elected president, and that is increased capital investment. I think there's going to be a little more reticence to invest into new projects in South Africa, so long as that there is uncertainty about exactly what is meant by land expropriation. expropriation without compensation.
You see, that's the big thing. It just needs a little bit of clarity on exactly what you're talking about. Now, Cyril Ramaphosa has said no smash and grab, but we need from him that clarity just to say, what are you talking about? Will your money be safe? And also, what land are you talking about?
And unfortunately, that discussion has not really taken place completely. Ramaphosa himself, in fact, on the very day that he was appointed president of the ANC, said, yes, that is our policy, but we need to investigate what we mean by that policy, because if it means taking away land from farmers that are really producing good food for us, then it's a no-go. We've got to make quite sure that food security remains intact. We've got to make quite sure that we have allocated all the spare land that is already in government's hands and in municipal hands before we start thinking about destructive forms of land expropriation without compensation. But we still don't know what the answers to those questions are.
Yeah, that's the big thing. Director and Chief Economist at Econometrics, Dr. Azar Jameen. I really do appreciate your time this afternoon on the Midday Report.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
14 minutes to 1 o'clock, and some of your SMSs. One says, Ray, we cannot keep building single-story houses across the country. It's time for high-rise flats for the poor. Single-story houses are a waste of precious time and land. That's not a bad idea. Another one says, good afternoon, Ray. There's no informal settlements in Limpopo. Why is this? Then another one says, for as long as we don't develop jobs in the country, people will leave their wonderful homes in other provinces and demand more houses where they find work. The challenge of housing will never be won. That Ollie in Johannesburg, I think you're quite right, actually. You have to develop industry in various provinces. A lot of people come from the Eastern Cape, say, for instance, to Gauteng or the Western Cape, and you do have to ask yourself the question, why is this happening?
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
The ANC's National Executive Committee met at the weekend to discuss a number of issues facing the party, just as the news broke of former President Jacob Zuma heading to court. A two-day meeting was held in Cape Town yesterday for the ANC's NEC. The party was very clear on ANC regalia not being used at the courts, and those supporting Zuma must do so in their capacity. That was the big thing. On the line is policy fellow at the Institute for Race Relations in South Africa, Sarah Gon. Good afternoon, Sarah. Welcome to the Midday Report.
Thanks very much.
It appears there's now no way for Jacob Zuma to avoid these charges relating to the arms deal. Can he really get himself out of this?
I don't think so. It's really a matter of when, not if. I think the work has been done from a point of view of investigating the matter. The details are there. And it's really a question of whether there's any way he can drag it out. And obviously with criminal proceedings, there are various bases on which there may be postponements, and there's also the potential that he will actually challenge Sean Abrams' decision. But essentially the process has started, and at the end of the day, the only way out would be actually to be found not guilty.
That's one thing. And then the fresh allegations against Jacob Zuma, Kassatu Sudumo Dlamini as well, and others. This was in the City Press at the weekend, in connection with allegedly taking money regarding the agriculture minister. He's fighting battles on many fronts.
He is. And the interesting thing about that one, certainly the way I see it, I hadn't heard before of this particular alleged act of criminality. And this, in a way, if this particular issue, if it's dealt with on its own, may well, if found him guilty of a criminal offence, would put Jacob Zuma in prison without necessarily having to go all the way down the line on this range of charges that have existed for 16 years. It's very neat, almost neat and cut and dried. If it can be proved. It may startlingly shorten the processes completely.
And then, okay, so let's park those charges and what he's doing. Let's look at the ANC now. They're in a very difficult position. They had the NEC yesterday, and they've said to their members, please, if you do go to court, go in your own personal capacity, but don't wear ANC colours. That's very interesting.
It's interesting, but I think there's very little likelihood that it will be obeyed. I think the factionalism within the ANC, and particularly for those who support Jacob Zuma, I think would define that at a turn. People will be there in ANC colours, because I think it's generally agreed that Cyril Ramaphosa has not inherited a united ANC. So who is the ANC will be determined by who belongs to which faction. So I think it's very unlikely that the NEC would be listened to on that.
Yeah, but he still enjoys quite a bit of support within the governing party. It seems like that support is still there and people are still in mm-hmm. two minds about him.
Yes, very much so. I think the request that people go there in their private capacity, not wearing ANC regalia, is a sign that the pro-Zuma faction is still strong within the organisation. So there's been a sort of polite attempt to say, please don't do it. It doesn't represent the organisation as a whole. But it doesn't really resolve anything for the ANC. The sort of divisions remain.
No, absolutely. Sarah Gonn, Policy Fellow at the Institute for Race Relations in South Africa. I do appreciate your time this afternoon on the Midday Report.
The Midday Report.
If you grew up in the 1980s and 1990s and beyond, you will know the songs of UB40. No party was the same without the songs or sounds of Red Red Wine and others as well. UB40 will be returning for their 25th SA anniversary tour. I can't wait. That's in a month or so's time. And on the line is the lead singer of UB40, Ali Campbell. Good afternoon, Ali. Welcome to the Midday Report.
Well, thank you for talking to me. How's it all going over there?
It's going not too bad. Now, I returned to South Africa. You must like it, yeah.
I love it there, yeah. The last time we were there, which was about 18 months ago, I think, I've been to South Africa ever since Mr. Mandela was released. You know, before that, we upheld the cultural boycott. But then when we were allowed to come, we've been back many, many, many times. And the last time I was there in Cape Town, I fell in love with the place. It was just what I saw, even though I've been coming for years. We got a local guy to take us around in a van, and it was just the most beautiful day out, you know, in Cape Town. So I can't wait to come back, yeah? I love it.
Sounds great. Now, also a return to you for UB40. You were on your own for a while.
Yeah. Well, I left my own band. It's kind of old news now. I left my own band, the band that I started in 1979, but I left it 10 years ago now. And so there's two UB40s out there. There's a UB40, the remaining guys, you know, with I call them the dark side. And then there's the sunny side, which is my UB40, which you always know it's me because I say UB40 featuring Ali Astro and Mickey.
Right, okay. Okay, now your brother Duncan took up the main vocals for a while. He must miss singing because you do have that distinctive sound.
Well, no, he doesn't sing anything like me, as it happens.
Yep.
He used to be a folk singer, you know, so I don't really think he's equipped to sing, you know, the reggae songs and the hits that, you know, that I had back in the day. It's all very unfortunate, you know, I've seen little bits of film of them performing, and I find them very embarrassing, actually. I mean, we've just gone into number two in the charts with our new album. Mm. And you know, me and Astro, we are the original singers of UB40 that were on all the hits and everything. So, you know, really, we are the ones to come and see,
now,
in my opinion.
No, it sounds good, and that's exactly what we're going to be doing. Now, Ali, how has your music changed throughout the years? I mean, you've had the Labour of Love albums that have come out. Has it changed, or is it just the same UB40 that we've come to know and love?
Well, obviously it's the same UB40 you've come to know and love because it's still me doing all the singing, you know. And we've only done four Labour of Love albums and we've done about 28, you know, self-penned albums and stuff. So a lot of people thought that we became a covers band, you know, but that was just because of the success of the Labour of Love series. And the new album, we've called that A Real Labour of Love, just to differentiate from the first three, you know. And it's exactly the same as it ever was. It's us covering old classics, reggae classics, you know, and bringing them into a contemporary sort of vibe, you know. And I think the only thing that's changed is the production is better because we produce our own stuff. And, you know, I think over the years I've finally learned how to balance the bass drum and the bass guitar, you know, on my 31st album.
took a while. I've always wanted to ask you this. Where did you get the motivation or the inspiration maybe to write Red Red Wine?
Well, we didn't write it. It was written, in fact, by Neil Diamond. And
that's
nobody
right.
was as surprised as us. Yeah, we were very shocked when we found that out because we knew it as a Tony Tribe sort of rocksteady classic or a ska classic even. Mm. And that was one of the songs that we grew up listening to when we were little kids, you know. And we loved reggae. Where we grew up, it was predominantly West Indian immigrants, you know. So the music of the streets was reggae, and I thought everybody loved reggae until I went to secondary school and everyone else was listening to Mark Bolan and Gary Glitter and David Bowie and all that stuff, you know. So that was the whole reason for doing the Labour of Love series. You know, the question we were most often asked was, you know, why do we play reggae? And those were a collection of the songs, you know, Cherry O' Baby and Kingston Town and Red Red Wine. Those were the songs that we grew up listening to and that made us love reggae, you know.
Yeah.
The new album, The Real Labour of Love, this is a collection of songs from the 80s when we were already up and running as a band. And these are the songs that made us continue to love reggae, you know. All through the 80s was a very, very great time for reggae. And it changed. It went digital, you know, with tracks like Sleng Teng, where they started using synthesizers instead of real bass guitars. So we all went digital in the 80s, and we've kind of just covered, you know, a bunch of classic reggae tracks from the 80s.
Mm. Now, what can South Africans expect this time around?
Well, you know, we've been touring as UB40 featuring Ali Astro and Mickey for nearly 5 years now, all around the world, including we've been to South Africa. And what we do is, we're not self-indulgent, you know. We've got a new album out, so we'll be playing, you know, maybe three tracks from that. But generally, it's a greatest hits set that we do, you know. We were very lucky in the 80s and 90s to have had sort of 40 top 20 hits. So we've got a wealth of stuff to choose from, you know. And we've sort of honed down a hits set, basically. So it'll be everyone a winner, you know, all thrillers, no fillers.
That sounds really good. Lead singer of UB40, Ali Campbell, thanks for joining us this afternoon. I really do appreciate you coming on to 702 in Cape Talk.
Okay, big love to everybody in Cape Town, and we'll see you soon in May.
Lovely, thank you. That's Ali Campbell, the lead singer of UB40.